associate pastors together at a church in St. Petersburg. And we had the wonderful privilege of working with our best friend, who was the youth pastor at that church. So it would happen that often we would be working, doing church things till late, and we would all decide to go out to eat together. Since we ate out so often, and we ate out so late, often 10 o'clock or so, it became a real challenge to find a new place to eat that was open past 9 o'clock at night. Well, on one of these evenings, we had been, I think, at administrative board rather late, and we hadn't eaten before the meeting, and we piled into William's truck and said, "Where are we going to eat tonight?" Well, as driving down the road, we spotted a little diner that we hadn't really noticed before. And so we said, "Well, let's try that place. We haven't been in there." We pulled in. We were thankful that they were open till 11 o'clock, so we had a good hour to just sit there and enjoy each other's company and eat. We had found that sitting down and eating together was just a wonderful experience of fellowship and friendship. In fact, the Hebrew tradition has a real sense of breaking bread together, of sitting down at table with each other as being a significantly spiritual experience. You only sat down to eat with people who you wanted to be in fellowship with. Masters did not sit down and eat with slaves. I don't even think men necessarily sat down to eat with women. And certainly, Jews did not sit down to eat with Gentiles. Persons sat down to eat with people, and in doing so, were saying to them, "You are my brother. You are my equal. I reconcile myself to you." You remember the significance of the Last Supper meal was that Jesus broke bread with his disciples, and even Judas, who he knew was going to betray him, was there. And when he broke the bread and dipped it, he handed it to Judas as a sign of reconciliation, as a sign that he still loved him, that he was still a part of his community. William and Joe and myself found that sitting down and eating together was a wonderful time of community, of Christian community. You can see why the Pharisees then were so concerned and so upset that Jesus was sitting down and breaking bread with and eating with persons who were very irreligious people. It was a sign that he was saying to them, "You are my brother, you are my friend, and I accept you as you are." It was a dangerous move. And they were murmuring against him. Well, as we were sitting there celebrating our Christian fellowship together, talking and enjoying one another's company, our waitress had been paying attention, something we hadn't quite expected. And she walks up to us and she says, "Y'all are Christians, aren't you?" And our mouth hits the table and we start to think, "Oh my gosh, what have we been saying?" We didn't realize someone was listening. She said, "Well, I'm a Christian too," which relieved us right away. She said, "And let me tell you how that came about." She began to unfold this incredible story to us. She had not always been a Christian. She hadn't been raised in the church. In fact, she would not have probably been comfortable coming into a church. She certainly would not have been comfortable just being around like Carter is up here. A church would have been a very scary place to her, and not a place that she would have expected to find acceptance. She had lived a very hard life. She had run around with a very hard crowd. And I was kind of wishing Tom was here, because part of the crowd she ran around with were bikers. And not the Christian biker type. She ran around with such a hard crowd that one of her friends ended up in prison. And because they were friends, and because she felt like she should do something. After he'd been in a while, she decided to kind of just send him a friendly letter to let him know that she hadn't forgotten him and some of the things that were going on the outside. He wrote her back. Not surprising. He wouldn't have much else to do in prison. But the contents of this letter, of this man that she had known before he went to prison, surprised her. Somehow, in the midst of being in that prison, he had met with and come to know Jesus Christ as his personal Lord and Savior. It had changed his life, and he shared the contents of that story with her. And ended the letter by inviting her to come to know Jesus too. Well, they began to correspond, and in the midst of their correspondence, she did in fact accept Christ and become a Christian. Well, now she needed to find a church. And he kept writing to her and saying, you need a Christian fellowship. You need to be going to church. But she was well aware of those Pharisee types that care about your past and care about what you were and how you dress. She was aware of that older brother mentality that says, after what you've done, come here? How dare you? So she goes to her closet to choose her outfit for that Sunday morning. She chooses very carefully with all of this in mind. And she pulls out the smallest, tiniest, tightest leather miniskirt she can find. And the skinniest strap, tightest halter top she has in her closet. And the most inappropriate shoes. They go with the outfit, but they're not what you wear to church. She does her makeup and her hair with the same kinds of thoughts. She's chosen her outfit not just for that, but also to make sure that every single one of her tattoos shows. She knows about church, or so she thinks. And she figures if she walks through that door, they're going to have to accept her for just who she is. And if they don't, she's off the hook. She doesn't have to go back. It's their fault. They haven't acted like Christians, and she doesn't have to be around them. So she walks in the door of the church in her tight little skinny leather miniskirt, her tight little tank top, and every single one of her tattoos showing. And she finds a seat on the back row. To her utter amazement, no one in the church seems to notice her outfit. And no one seems to take notice of her tattoos that she was so carefully displaying. And instead, they seem to only notice her. And that day, she is surrounded with such a love and acceptance that she finds her heart melted. My image in my head is of the Father. The church acting as the Father in the story of the prodigal son, wrapping their arms around her and saying, welcome home. We wondered how long it would take you to come back. She becomes an active part of that church. She becomes a person who truly lives her faith, as you can see by the fact, you know, that she is witnessing to two pastors and a youth minister. And I mean, you know, like our salad at this point is hanging out of our mouth. Our chin is on the floor. I mean, we are just astounded is one of the most incredible stories we've ever heard. But she says, and then, and we know there's more to come. She said, and then my father, who I haven't spoken with in more than 10 years, got very sick. In fact, he was dying. And he was in the hospital, and he had asked to see me. And the truth was, I didn't want to see him. I had become a Christian. I had done a lot to forgive him, but I wasn't there. You see, there was a reason I had nothing to do with my father. My father mistreated all of us kids. And she didn't go into a lot of detail, but you really got the impression that he was physically, mentally, and most definitely sexually abusive of her. This was not a man she ever wanted to see again. But for some reason, she felt that she just really had to do this to live out her faith, this grace and forgiveness and mercy that she had found. She needed to find a way to forgive this man. She needed to go and see him and let him know what had happened in her life. So she went. And she visited with her father, and she told him that she had found Christ. She told him about the forgiveness, and she told him about the change of life. And she told him that she was forgiving him too. The conversation didn't seem to go real well on his part. He seemed to not be so different than he'd been before, a little gruff, a little distant, a little hard for her to relate to. And when she left knowing that she needed to go back the next day because he wasn't going to be too many more days in this world. She walked in the room the next day and looked at him and knew there was something different. She could see it in his eyes. She could see it on his face. She could just see it, even in this dying man. There was a sense of difference. There was a sense of joy. There was a sense of love. And she told us that as she sat there, he unfolded to her how his night had gone and how he had given his heart to Jesus. And he asked her to forgive him for everything he had ever done to her. She said, I looked in his eyes and I knew this was no deathbed confession to make everything right. She could see in his eyes that he truly knew the love of God. He truly had felt the embrace and the forgiveness. And she left when she left. She said she got to her car and she just started bawling. And then she started screaming. And she started lifting her fist towards heaven and saying, how could you? How could you, Lord, forgive him after what he did to me? She said it took her days to get over the rage and the anger. She was the one that had witnessed to him. She was the one who had gone. But she realized that deep in her heart, it was to get the guilt off her chest. It wasn't because she wanted him found. She would have been glad to see him stay lost. She was no longer the prodigal. She was now the elder brother, standing there before her father saying, how could you, after everything he's done, accept him back and love him? She said that God came to her and ministered to her and loved her. And I suppose in some sense she heard those same words that the elder brother had heard so long ago in Jesus' story. We had to celebrate. Your father, who was dead, is now alive. He was lost and has been found. I've always noticed that the prodigal son story doesn't exactly end. We don't find out how the elder brother, the eldest son, responded to the father's compassion for him, responded to the father's words. It's left open-ended. Perhaps Jesus left it open because he hoped that the Pharisees and the scribes who were listening would write the end of their story by their own response. My story of this woman in the restaurant doesn't really end either. Because even on that day, although she had found it in her heart to enter the banquet room, she hadn't yet sat down at the table. She hadn't yet found that ability to be completely joyful, not just in her head, but in her heart, for what God had done for her father. And she confessed that and shared that with us and ministered to us in such a way. And I found myself thinking, how many times do we fail to witness? Not for the reasons we say, because we're scared, because they might not respond, because we're afraid they might. They might respond. They might find Jesus. They might no longer be lost. They might come sit right beside us in the pew. Their mansion might be beside ours in heaven, and then we'd have to deal with them for eternity. Her words that stuck the most for me, I think, were these. She said, as she flailed her fist towards heaven and screamed at God about how could he, she said these words, "This is why I didn't want to go see him, Lord. This is why I didn't want to share my story. Because I knew, knowing you, you'd do something just like this. That you would love the unlovable and ask me to do the same."